So, think about this for a second. If you turned on your laptop today and you suddenly discovered it was running on like thousands of lines of untested code,
Oh, man.
right? Like code written by complete strangers, code that had never been debugged, and it was just actively overwriting your own commands, you wouldn't just sit there and be okay with it. You'd wipe the hard drive
Yeah,
immediately.
you'd assume the whole system was compromised. I mean, you wouldn't trust that machine to send a basic email, let alone run your actual life.
Exactly. But here's the wild part. When it comes to our human belief systems, that is precisely how most of us operate every single day. We are just running on this untested mental code.
We really are.
So, welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today isn't to sit here and tell you what you should or shouldn't believe. The mission is to kind of tear down the walls of how you've been programmed to believe in the first place. We're looking at what I would call a masterclass in mental debugging today. We're diving into chapter 12 from the book Laws of Life, book one, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by Jack Spurko. And the chapter is perfectly titled Believe as You Wish, But Know Why You Believe What You Believe.
Which is such a heavy mandate when you really think about it. And honestly, it's why our combined backgrounds are so relevant for this specific deep dive. Because in my practice as a career and education decision coach, literally my entire job is helping young adults stress test their underlying assumptions because they're making these massive, incredibly expensive life choices. And I always tell them the most dangerous assumptions are always the ones you don't even realize you've made.
Oh, absolutely. And, as a critical thinking and media literacy instructor, I spend my days teaching students how to look at this totally chaotic media landscape, evaluate claims, spot the inherent bias, and just separate objective facts from, well, carefully packaged opinions.
Which is harder than ever right now.
It really is. And Spurko's core law in this chapter merges both of our worlds so perfectly. He argues that, look, you are perfectly free to believe whatever you want, that's fine. The massive, glaring problem in our society isn't that people have beliefs.
No, it's how we get them.
Yes, it's that we inherit these completely untested beliefs from authority figures or just through sheer repetition, from our parents, the media, our culture. We just accept them based purely on emotion.
And then we aggressively, like sometimes violently, defend them without ever actually stopping to examine them.
Exactly. So to understand why we do this, we really have to look at the underlying mechanics of human psychology. Like, why on earth would someone fiercely defend a borrowed belief?
Well, the chapter points straight to cognitive dissonance, which I think most people recognize as that really severe mental discomfort you feel when your beliefs are suddenly challenged by reality.
Right, but the author takes it a step deeper. He introduces two psychological mechanisms that basically act as a defense system for that discomfort: confirmation bias and perception bias.
Yeah, those are
Let
huge.
me put my media literacy hat on for a second here. The best way to understand confirmation bias is to imagine your brain putting on a pair of really high-tech noise-canceling headphones.
I like that.
It literally filters out frequencies, or in this case, facts, that disrupt the song it's already playing. Once you decide you believe something, your perception becomes so warped that you actively hunt for information to confirm it.
While going completely blind to anything that contradicts it.
Right, because you're trying to conserve mental energy and protect your identity.
See, but I struggle with this premise sometimes. Let's just play this out logically for a second.
Okay.
If someone hands you solid, conclusive proof that your deeply held belief is false, like, say, a literal math sheet proving your timeline is totally wrong, why wouldn't a rational human brain just look at the evidence, experience maybe a brief moment of dissonance, and then just accept the truth?
Because the brain isn't prioritizing truth, it's prioritizing survival.
Yeah.
And it views an attack on a core belief as an actual, literal attack on its identity. The counterintuitive finding the author highlights here is that the absurdity of belief defense just knows no bounds. People won't just reject the conclusive proof, they will actually experience this backfire
Oh,
effect.
the backfire effect is wild.
It is. They'll use that contradictory evidence to somehow confirm their existing bias. They'll look at undeniable proof that they're wrong and twist it to say, well, actually, the fact that you are trying so hard to prove me wrong just proves there's a massive conspiracy against my truth.
It's a complete short circuit of basic logic.
Driven entirely by the emotional need to protect that untested code we talked about. And if you want a perfect example of how this code gets installed in the first place, we can look at a story you have almost certainly heard. The boiling frog metaphor.
Oh man, this is such a classic. So the story goes that if you drop a frog in boiling water, it immediately jumps out. But if you put it in a pot of cold water and just slowly turn up the heat, the frog won't notice the gradual change and it'll just peacefully boil to death.
Right.
And speakers use it constantly, right, to illustrate creeping government overreach or corporate burnout or just societal decline.
It's an incredibly sticky rhetorical tool. The only problem is it's complete biological fiction.
Totally fake.
The author brings this fantastic reality check to this, drawing on his own lifelong experience as a reptile and amphibian enthusiast. He explains the actual mechanics of how cold-blooded animals survive. Anyone who has ever set up a terrarium knows you have to create what's called a thermal gradient.
Right. You don't heat the whole glass box uniformly.
No. You put a heat lamp on one side and you leave the other side cool.
Because a frog's entire existence relies on actively moving around to regulate its body temperature. It naturally seeks out a Goldilocks zone. So if it gets too hot, it just moves to the shade. If it gets cold, it moves back to the basking rock.
Exactly. So the fundamental premise that a creature hardwired for active temperature regulation would just sit perfectly still while water slowly boils around it is just biologically absurd. A frog would absolutely jump out to find its Goldilocks zone the absolute second the water got uncomfortable.
Right. And the author actually admits he used to use this fake story in his own presentations.
Yeah.
Before his brain finally engaged and he thought, wait a minute, I know how frogs work. Why am I even saying this?
Which brings up the most crucial question here. Why do intelligent people violently defend a fake story about a frog that doesn't even practically matter to their daily lives?
It all comes down to the mechanics of repetition and perceived authority.
Yep.
If you hear a story repeated constantly, especially by someone standing on a stage in a suit in front of a massive audience, your brain just bypasses the critical thinking filter entirely. It just stamps it as true. Repetition is basically the ultimate vector for installing untested code.
It really is. But even if you know the boiling frog is a myth now, you probably still catch yourself believing things just because you've heard them 100 times. And why is that? Because we spent the first crucial developmental years of our lives in an environment entirely designed to reward us for accepting authority without question.
The school system.
We have to look at the classroom. 13 years of institutional schooling is essentially a masterclass in conditioning.
Oh, absolutely.
And the author shares a couple of really compelling examples of this indoctrination. Now, just operating strictly as an impartial reporter of the text here, without taking any political stance whatsoever, I really want to look at how fear and authority shape young minds in these anecdotes. So first, he talks about his 8-year-old grandson coming home deeply upset, experiencing this intense, crushing guilt over simply riding in a car.
Right, and this was due to the climate change lessons he was receiving at school. He had internalized this belief that he was personally destroying the entire planet just by being driven home.
Yeah, and as the author astutely notes, this isn't even a debate about the science of climate change, not at all. It's an observation about an 8-year-old boy being programmed with profound fear and guilt by an authority figure long before he has the cognitive development to even process it.
It's heavy.
It is. But the second example from the text provides a much more mechanical look at this conditioning, I think. The author recalls his own 8th grade science textbook from 1982.
Oh, the oil reserve thing.
Yes. There was this prominent infographic claiming that all the oil, coal, and natural gas in the world would be completely gone in exactly 35 years.
Not peak oil production. Completely gone. Like empty. Which, if you run the math from 1982, means the world would run completely dry in 2017.
Right. So think about the glitch in the matrix this created for him. He's a 13-year-old kid. His dad literally runs a gas station, so this feels super existential to him.
Yeah, that's his livelihood.
He does the basic math on a piece of scratch paper, realizes 2017 is a long way off, and he audibly sighs in relief. But the teacher scowls at him, utterly dismisses the math, and insists that major shortages will happen long before then, and gas is going to be $20 a gallon soon.
The teacher's reaction is the defining mechanism here. Instead of validating the student's critical thinking and, you know, basic arithmetic, the authority figure enforces compliance to the panic narrative.
Exactly. The author actually went to the library later, looked up known oil reserves, and proved the textbook was demonstrably false. But the lesson the school system was trying to teach wasn't actually about oil. It was about compliance.
And that brings up a fascinating critique the chapter makes about modern grading, which I know was right in my wheelhouse as a coach. The author uses a really simple math example. Say the correct answer to a problem is x equals 4. A student might intuitively know the answer is 4, write it down for 30 consecutive problems, get every single one mathematically perfect, and still fail the assignment.
Wow. Yeah. Because the process is weighed heavier than the actual truth.
Exactly. In many systems, getting the correct answer is only worth maybe 25% of the grade. You could do all the formatting steps the teacher's way, get every single final answer completely wrong, and still pass the class. So think about what that actually does to a developing brain. What is the mechanism of that conditioning?
It severs the relationship between the student and objective truth.
Spot on. It conditions students to stop pursuing actual truth and instead wait for validation. Getting the right answer stops being the goal. Being told you are a good student by an authority figure becomes the sole objective.
It just breeds conformity over curiosity.
It really does. You end up with a generation of workers who, as the text quotes George Carlin, are just smart enough to run the machines, but just passive enough to accept their situation. They never develop the critical thinking muscles necessary to know why they believe what they believe.
So you spent 13 years learning that the authority figure's validation matters way more than the objective truth. What happens when you graduate high school? You are perfectly primed to accept the most expensive, life-altering piece of untested code our culture offers.
Oh, there we go.
The ultimate borrowed assumption. Every child should go to college.
Yeah. And if you're listening to this and you're currently paying off massive student loans for a degree you barely even use, you know exactly what this pain point feels like.
Oh, yeah.
This is the assumption I have to dismantle every single day with clients. The author attacks this claim with basic, undeniable logic. If literally every single child goes to a four-year university, who builds the houses? Who welds the structural steel for the cruise ships you vacation on? Who operates the 60,000-pound highway excavators?
Right, and those aren't fallback jobs. Those are highly lucrative, super necessary trades that require zero university degrees. Yet they are treated as secondary by the school system's conditioning.
To illustrate this, the author draws a brilliant contrast between an education that serves a specific life goal and what he really bluntly calls an educated idiot.
I love that term.
He looks at his own nephew, who went to a top law school, earned a highly specific and useful degree, and became an assistant attorney general. That degree made structural sense. It was a required tool. But then he compares that to a web developer he once hired.
The developer who showed up with a really prestigious marketing degree and $65,000 in student debt.
Right. A guy who couldn't market water in a desert. He was entirely unemployable in his actual field of study. He only became hireable after locking himself in a room for a month and basically self-teaching PHP and MySQL programming out of a stack of Sam's teacher self paperbacks.
The stakes there are wild when you really lay them out. Like, he paid $65,000 for a piece of paper that provided zero utility. But his actual livelihood, his ability to feed himself, came from a $50 stack of paperbacks he bought at a local bookstore.
Which forces us to look at the return on investment, or ROI, of education. And I'll tell you, when I bring up ROI with parents, it frequently turns into a highly hostile conversation.
I bet.
The author notes this exact same phenomenon. Parents want the emotional bragging rights. They want to stand at a dinner party and say, oh, my boy is off at the university. They are secretly terrified their kid will open a spreadsheet, run the actual numbers, and realize the math just doesn't work.
Because there are alternatives today that completely bypass that debt trap entirely. The text mentions a specific program through discoverpraxis.com, which is an $11,000 boot camp. But the mechanism of this boot camp is fascinating. Students actually earn their full tuition back during the internship phase.
That's incredible.
Yeah, they essentially get the training for free, build a real portfolio, and learn how to actually market themselves in the real world.
But I know what you're thinking.
Yeah.
Because I hear this defense every single time I bring up alternatives. People always throw the exact same statistic back at me. They say, well, but the data proves that college graduates out-earn non-graduates over their lifetimes.
Yeah, it's the ultimate trump card in the debate. If the data is true, how can you possibly argue with it?
Well, you don't argue with the data. You argue with the logic of the conclusion. The author uses this as a perfect example of drawing an illogical conclusion from a true claim.
Right.
Yes, the broad statistic is true. Graduates generally out-earn non-graduates. But the conclusion that college is always a good financial decision for every individual completely ignores the underlying variables. It conflates correlation with causation. Think about the traits required to even get into a good college. General intelligence, drive, family support, networking skills. Those smarter, more driven people would likely succeed and earn higher incomes with or without the piece of paper.
So you're saying the degree gets the credit for the individual's inherent ambition?
Precisely. And to further dismantle that narrative, the author drops two massive statistical realities. Over 40% of the first jobs that new graduates get don't even require a college degree.
Wow.
And furthermore, only 25 to 30% of graduates actually end up working in a field related to their major. When you ignore those underlying facts, you aren't making a financial decision. You're just blindly accepting a really clever marketing slogan.
So we have this massive problem. Our internal hard drives are packed with this untested code, installed by 13 years of schooling, heavily enforced by parental bragging rights, repeated constantly by the media, and protected by our own cognitive dissonance. How do we actually rewrite it? Well, the author provides a highly practical real-time filter to run our assumptions through. He calls it the KNOW method, KNOW.
It's such a brilliant framework because it slows down the emotional reaction. It starts with K, know if it matters. Before you engage in a debate or adopt in a new belief, ask yourself, does this claim actually affect your life? Do you actually care about the outcome?
Right. It's a triage system for your mental energy. If a politician says something totally outrageous about a zoning law three states over and it has zero impact on your life, your family, or your finances, hit the brakes. Just stop wasting processing power on it.
Assuming the claim does matter to you, you move to M. Notice the bullshit. Does the claim defy basic common sense or established knowledge? The author uses a great regional example here. If a guy at a bar claims he shot a 15-foot Western Diamondback rattlesnake in Texas, your BS detector should immediately go off.
Yeah, because basic biological knowledge tells us the official record for that snake is around 7'7", so a claim of 15 feet isn't even worth your time to investigate. It just fails the sniff test completely.
Exactly.
But here is the critical rule the author borrows from basic journalism. If a claim does pass that initial sniff test, you still cannot just accept it. You must verify it with at least two independent sources. One source, no matter how trusted they are, is never enough.
Which flows perfectly into the O. Observe what it really is. You have to categorize the claim so you know how to properly evaluate it. And the author breaks claims down into three distinct types. First, you have hard facts. For example, I have a car in my garage that runs entirely on water. That is a physical, measurable claim that is definitively true or false. Second, you have opinions. Company X makes the best widget on the market. That is entirely subjective because my definition of best might mean cheapest, while yours means most durable.
Right. But the third category is where almost everyone gets trapped. Unknown future outcomes.
This is the danger zone right here. The author cites a futurist named Tony Seba and his Clean Disruption presentation. Seba made a bold claim that in 10 to 15 years, almost all cars on the road will be electric and self-driving.
Oh, man. People will argue about a claim like that for hours on social media. They treat it as if it's a present-day reality they desperately need to defend.
But the mechanism of that claim makes it entirely impossible to debate as a fact. It will eventually have a definitive right or wrong answer, sure, but we literally cannot know if his timeline is correct until the year 2035 arrives. You have to observe that a claim is currently unknowable, rather than letting it install itself as a present-day fact in your software.
That brings us to the final and honestly most difficult step, W, weigh what you know. This requires brutal intellectual honesty. The author references a brilliant analogy from a podcast called Pulling the Thread.
I love this one.
The concept is simple but devastating. If you took a room full of people who are fiercely, emotionally debating a hot-button issue, and you handed them a blank sheet of paper, and you forced them to write down only the actual, verifiable, underlying facts they know about the subject, no opinions, no slogans, just hard facts.
Most of them would just be staring at a blank sheet of paper.
Exactly. It forces you to realize how hollow most borrowed beliefs really are. The standard here is ruthless. If you cannot logically, dispassionately argue both sides of an issue, you do not actually understand it. You are just holding a borrowed opinion that someone else programmed into you.
So if we look back at the blueprint Spirko gives us in Chapter 12, what are the key takeaways for you, the listener, as you try to debug your own mental software today? Well, the author provides a highly practical recap of these laws. First, recognize that belief without understanding is simply borrowed thinking.
Right.
Second, understand the mechanism of emotion. It has this dangerous, blinding ability to make logically weak ideas feel incredibly strong and personal. And third, while the objective truth does not require your belief to exist, Your belief should absolutely require the truth.
That is the ultimate standard right there. And if you want to dig deeper into these concepts and find more resources on designing a life built on tested solid foundations, you can check out jackslaws.com.
And to actually execute this rewrite, the author instructs the reader to consciously update their internal programming today. He provides three exact lines of mental code you need to install right now.
Okay, let's hear them.
Computer, when a claim matters, verify it before accepting it. Computer, treat discomfort as a signal to think deeper, not retreat. Computer, make truth more important than being right.
Make truth more important than being right. That is a profound upgrade to any operating system. Again, you can explore more at jackslaws.com. But before you go, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over.
Yeah.
If you successfully apply the KNOW method today, and you actively strip away all your borrowed beliefs, all the untested code you've inherited from your schooling, your parents, and your culture, who is the person left behind tomorrow, your current career path, your social circles, maybe even your most intimate relationships, are all built on the current buggy version of your software. Are you truly prepared for what happens to your life when you finally hit update?
It's a risk. But until you know why you believe what you believe, you aren't really the one driving the machine.